That wasn't just luck, was it?
Well, some, she said, trying for modesty. She failed and felt a grin blossom across her face. Maybe half. Roger went to retrieve her prize while she cleaned the gun again, coming back with a 10-pound bird, limp-necked and leaking blood like a punctured water skin. What a thing, he said. He held it at arm's length to drain, admiring the vivid reds and blues of the bare, warty head and dangling wattle. I don't think I've ever seen one, save roasted on a platter with chestnut dressing and roast potatoes. He looked from the turkey to her with great respect and nodded at the gun. That's great shooting, Bree. She felt her cheeks flush with pleasure and restrained the urge to say, "Aw, shucks, 'twarn't nothing," settling instead for a simple, "Thanks." They turned again toward home, Roger still carrying the dripping carcass, held slightly out from his body. "You haven't been shooting all that long either," Roger was saying, still impressed. "What's it been, 6 months?" She didn't want to lower his estimation of her prowess, but laughed, shrugged, and told the truth anyway. "More like 6 years. Really, more like 10. Eh? Daddy, Frank, taught me to shoot when I was 11 or 12. He gave me a 22 when I was 13, and by the time I was 15 he was taking me to shoot clay pigeons at ranges, or to hunt doves and quail on weekends in the fall." Roger glanced at her in interest. "I thought Jimmy taught you. I'd no idea Frank Randall was such a sportsman." "Well," she said slowly, "I don't know that he was." One black brow went up in inquiry. "Oh, he knew how to shoot," she assured him. "He'd been in the army during World War II. But he never shot much himself. He'd just show me and then watch. In fact, he never even owned a gun." "That's odd, isn't it?" She moved deliberately closer to him, nudging his shoulder so that their shadows merged again. Now it looked like a two-headed ogre carrying a gun over one shoulder and a third head held bloodily in its hand. "I wondered about that," she said with attempted casualness, "after you told me about his letter and all that at the gathering." He shot her a sharp look. "Wondered what?" She took a deep breath, feeling the linen strips bite into her breasts. "I wondered why a man who didn't ride or shoot should take such pains to see that his daughter could do both those things. I mean, it wasn't like it was common for girls to do that." She tried to laugh. "Not in Boston, anyway." There was no sound for a moment, but the shuffling of their feet through dry leaves. "Christ," Roger said softly at last. "He looked for Jamie Fraser. He said so in his letter." "And he found a Jamie Fraser. He said that too. We just don't know whether it was the right one or not." She kept her eyes on her boots, wary of snakes. There were copperheads in the wood, and timber rattlers. She saw them now and then, basking on rocks or sunny logs. Roger took a deep breath, lifting his head.
"Aye. And so you're wondering now, what else might he have found?"
She nodded, not looking up.
"Maybe he found me," she said softly.
Her throat felt tight.
"Maybe he knew I'd go back through the stones.
But if he did, he didn't tell me." He stopped walking and put a hand on her arm to turn her toward him.
"And perhaps he didn't know that at all," he said firmly. "He may only have thought you might try it, if you ever found out about Fraser. And if you did find out, and did go, then he wanted you to be safe. I'd say no matter what he knew, that's what he wanted, you to be safe."
He smiled a little crookedly.
"Like you want me to be safe, aye?"
She heaved a deep sigh, feeling comfort descend on her with his words. She'd never doubted that Frank Randall had loved her all the years of her growing up. She didn't want to doubt it now.
"Aye,"
she said, and tilted up an inch on her toes to kiss him.
"Fine, then," he said,
and gently touched her breast where the buckskin of her shirt showed a small wet patch.
"Jem'll be hungry. Come on, it's time we were home."
They turned again and went down the mountain into the golden sea of chestnut leaves, watching their shadows go before them as they walked, embracing. "Do you think," she began, and hesitated. One shadow head dipped toward the other, listening. "Do you think Ian's happy?"
"I hope so," he replied,
and his arm tightened round her.
"If he has a wife like mine, then I'm sure he is."
This ends Disc 10. The Fiery Cross, Disc 11.
Chapter 21. 2020. Now hold this over your left eye and read the smallest line you can see clearly. With a long-suffering air, Roger held the wooden spoon over his right eye and narrowed his left, concentrating on the sheet of paper I had pinned to the kitchen door. He was standing in the front hall, just inside the door, as the length of the corridor was the only stretch of floor within the house approaching 20 feet.
"Et tu, Brute?" he read.
He lowered the spoon and looked at me, one dark eyebrow raised.
"I've never seen a literate eye chart before."
"Well, I always did think that the F-E-5-Z-T-D things on the regular chart's rather boring," I said, unpinning the paper and flipping it over. "Other eye, please. What's the smallest line you can read easily?" He reversed the spoon, squinted at the 5 lines of hand printing, done in such even decrements of size as I could manage, and read the 3rd one slowly.
"Eat no onions. What's that from?"
"Shakespeare, of course," I said, making a note. "Eat no onions nor garlic, for we are to utter a sweet breath." "That's the smallest you can read, is it?" I saw Jamie's expression alter subtly. He and Brianna were standing just behind Roger out on the porch, watching the proceedings with great interest. Brianna was leaning slightly toward Roger, a faintly anxious expression on her face as though willing him to see the letters. Jamie's expression, though, showed slight surprise, faint pity, and an undeniable glint of satisfaction. He, evidently, could read the 5th line without trouble. "I honour him." One from Julius Caesar. "As he was valiant, I honour him. As he was ambitious, I slew him." He felt my gaze on him, and the expression vanished, his face instantly resuming its usual look of good-humoured inscrutability. I narrowed my eyes at him with a "you're not fooling me" sort of look, and he looked away, a corner of his mouth twitching slightly. "You can't make out any of the next line?" Bree had moved close to Roger, as though drawn by osmosis. She stared intently at the paper, then at him with an encouraging look. Obviously, she could see the last 2 lines without difficulty, too.
"No," Roger said, rather shortly.
He'd agreed to let me check his eyes at her request, but he obviously wasn't happy about it. He slapped the palm of his hand lightly with the spoon, impatient to be done with this.
"Anything else?"
"Just a few small exercises," I said, as soothingly as possible. "Come in here where the light is better." I put a hand on his arm and drew him toward my surgery, giving Jamie and Bree a hard look as I did so. "Brianna, why don't you go and lay the table for supper? We won't be long." She hesitated for a moment, but Jamie touched her arm and said something to her in a low voice. She nodded, glanced once more at Roger with a small anxious frown, and went. Jamie gave me an apologetic shrug and followed her. Roger was standing among the litter in my surgery, looking like a bear that hears barking hounds in the distance, simultaneously annoyed and wary.
"There's no need for this," he said, as I closed the door. "I see fine. I just don't shoot very well yet. There's nothing the matter with my eyes."
Still, he made no move to escape, and I picked up the hint of doubt in his voice.
"Shouldn't think there is,"
I said lightly. Let me just have a quick look, though. Just curiosity on my part, really. I got him sat down, however reluctantly, and for lack of the standard small flashlight, lit a candle. I brought it close to check the dilation of his pupils. His eyes were the most lovely colour, I thought. Not hazel at all, but a very clear, dark green. Dark enough to look almost black in shadow, but a startling colour, almost emerald, when seen directly in bright light. A disconcerting sight to one who had known Geely Duncan and had seen her mad humour laugh out of those clear green depths. I did hope Roger hadn't inherited anything but the eyes from her. He blinked once, involuntarily, long black lashes sweeping down over them, and the memory disappeared. These eyes were beautiful, but calm, and above all, sane. I smiled at him, and he smiled back in reflex, not understanding. I passed the candle before his face, up, down, right, left, asking him to keep looking at the flame, watching the changes as his eyes moved to and fro. Since no answers were required in this exercise, he began to relax a bit, his fists gradually uncurling on his thighs. Very nice, I said, keeping my voice low and soothing. Yes, that's good. Can you look up, please? Yes. Now look down, toward the corner by the window. Yes. Now, look at me again. You see my finger? Good. Now, close your left eye and tell me if the finger moves. Finally, I blew out the candle and straightened up, stretching my back with a small groan. So, Roger said lightly, what's the verdict, Doctor? Shall I go and be making myself a white cane? He waved away the drifting wisps of smoke from the blown-out candle, making a good attempt at casualness, belied only by the slight tension in his shoulders. I laughed. No, you won't need a seeing eye dog for some time yet, nor even spectacles. Though, speaking of that, you said you'd never seen a literate eye chart before. But you have seen eye charts, I take it. Did you ever wear glasses as a child? He frowned, casting his mind back. I did, he said slowly. Or rather, a faint grin showed on his face. I had a pair of specs, or two or three, when I was 7 or 8, I think. They were a nuisance and gave me a headache, so I was inclined to leave them on the public bus, or at school, or on the rocks by the river. I can't recall actually wearing them for more than an hour at a time, and after I'd lost the third pair, my father gave up. He shrugged. I've never thought as though I needed spectacles, to be honest. Well, you don't. Now? He caught the tone of my voice and looked down at me, puzzled. What? You're a bit short-sighted in the left eye, but not enough to cause you any real difficulty. I rubbed the bridge of my nose as though feeling the pinch of spectacles myself. Let me guess. You were good at hockey and football when you were at school, but not at tennis? He laughed at that, eyes crinkling at the corners. Tennis? At an Inverness grammar school. Soft southern sport, we'd have called it. Game for poofters. But I take your point. No, you're right. I was fine at the football, but not much at rounders. Why? You don't have any binocular vision, I said. Chances are that someone noticed it when you were a child and made an effort to correct it with prismatic lenses. But it's likely that it would have been too late by the time you were 7 or 8, I added hastily, seeing his face go blank. If that's going to work, it needs to be done very young, before the age of 5. I don't binocular vision. But doesn't everyone? I mean, both my eyes do work, don't they? He looked mildly bewildered. He looked down into the palm of his hand, closing one eye, then the other, as though some answer might be found among the lines there. Your eyes are fine, I assured him. It's just that they don't work together. It's really a fairly common condition, and many people who have it don't realize it. It's just that in some people, for one reason or another, the brain never learns to merge the images coming in from both eyes in order to make a three-dimensional image. I don't see in three dimensions. He looked at me, now squinting hard as though expecting me suddenly to flatten out against the wall. Well, I haven't quite got a trained oculist's kit. I waved a hand at the burned-out candle, the wooden spoon, the drawn figures, and a couple of sticks I'd been using. Nor yet an oculist's training. But I'm reasonably sure, yes. He listened quietly as I explained what I could. His vision seemed fairly normal in terms of acuity, but since his brain wasn't fusing the information from his eyes, he must be estimating the distance and relative location of objects simply by unconscious comparison of their sizes, rather than by forming a real 3D image, which meant... You can see perfectly well for almost anything you want to do, I assured him. And you very likely can learn to shoot all right. Most of the men I see shooting close one eye when they fire anyway. But you might have trouble hitting moving targets. You can see what you're aiming at all right, but without binocular vision, you may not be able to tell precisely where it is in order to hit it. I see, he said. So if it comes to a fight, I'd best rely on straightforward bashing, is that it? In my humble experience of Scottish conflicts, I said, most fights amount to no more than bashing anyway. You only use a gun or arrow if your goal is murder, and in that case a blade is usually the weapon of preference. So much surer, Jamie tells me. He gave a small grunt of amusement at that, but said nothing else. He sat quietly, considering what I told him, while I tidied up the disorder left by the day's surgery. I could hear thumping and clanging from the kitchen, and the pop and sizzle of fat that went with the tantalizing aroma of frying onions and bacon that floated down the corridor. It was going to be a hasty meal. Mrs. Bug had been busy all day with the preparations for the militia expedition. Still, even Mrs. Bug's least elaborate spreads were well worth the eating. Muffled voices came through the wall. Jemmy's sudden wail, a brief exclamation from Brianna, another from Lizzie. Then Jamie's deep voice, evidently comforting the baby while Bree and Lizzie dealt with dinner. Roger heard them too. I saw his head turn toward the sound. Quite a woman, he said with a slow smile. She can kill it and cook it, which looks like being a good thing under the circumstances, he added ruefully. Evidently I won't be putting much meat on the table. Pah, I said briskly, wishing to forestall any attempt on his part to feel sorry for himself. I've never shot a thing in my life, and I put food on this table every day. If you really feel you must kill things, you know there are plenty of chickens and geese and pigs. And if you can catch that damnable white sow before she undermines the foundation entirely, you'll be a local hero. That made him smile, though with a wry twist to it nonetheless. I expect my self-respect will recover with or without the pigs, he said. The worst of it will be telling the sharpshooters. He jerked his head toward the wall where Brianna's voice mingled with Jamie's in muffled conversation. What the problem is... They'll be very kind, like one is to somebody who's missing a foot. I laughed, finished swabbing out my mortar, and reached up to put it away in the cupboard. Bree's only worrying about you because of this regulation trouble. But Jamie thinks it won't amount to anything. The chances of you needing to shoot someone are very small. Besides, birds of prey haven't got monocular vision either, I added as an afterthought. Except for owls. Hawks and eagles can't have. Their eyes are on either side of their heads. Just tell Bree and Jamie I said you have eyes like a hawk. He laughed outright at that and stood up, dusting off the skirts of his coat. Right, I will. He waited for me, opening the door to the hall for me. As I reached it, though, he put a hand on my arm, stopping me. "This binocular thing," he said, gesturing vaguely toward his eyes. "I was born with it, I suppose." I nodded. "Yes, almost certainly." He hesitated, clearly not knowing quite how to put what he wanted to say.
"Is it inherited, then?"
"My father was in the RAF. He can't have had it, surely.
But my mother wore spectacles. She kept them on a chain round her neck. I remember playing with it. I might have gotten the eye thing from her, I mean."
I pursed my lips, trying to recall what, if anything, I'd ever read on the subject of inherited eye disorders. But nothing concrete came to mind.
"I don't know," I said at last. "It might be. But it might not, too.
I really don't know."
"Are you worried about Jimmy?"
"Oh." A faint look of disappointment crossed his features, though he blotted it out almost at once. He gave me an awkward smile and opened the door, holding it for me to pass through.
"No, not worried. I was just thinking, if it was inherited, and if the little fella should have it too, then I'd know."
The corridor was full of the savoury scents of squirrel stew and fresh bread, and I was starving. But I stood still, staring up at him.
"I wouldn't wish it on him," Roger said hastily, seeing my expression. "Not at all. Just if it should be that way."
He broke off and looked away, swallowing.
"Luke, don't tell Bree I thought of it, please."
I touched his arm lightly.
"I think she'd understand. You're wanting to know, for sure."
He glanced at the kitchen door, from which Bree's voice rose, singing Clementine to Jemmy's raucous pleasure.
"She might understand," he said. "That doesn't mean she wants to hear it."
Chapter 22. The Fiery Cross. The men were gone. Jamie, Roger, Mr. Chisholm and his sons, and the MacLeod brothers. They had all disappeared before daybreak, leaving no trace behind save the jumbled remains of a hasty breakfast and a collection of muddy boot prints on the doorsill. Jamie moved so quietly that he seldom woke me when he left our bed to dress in the dark pre-dawn. He did usually bend to kiss me goodbye, though, murmuring a quick endearment in my ear, and leaving me to carry the touch and scent of him back into dreams. He hadn't wakened me this morning. That job had been left to the tender offices of the junior Chisholms and MacLeods, several of whom had held a pitched battle directly under my window just after dawn. I had sprung into wakefulness, momentarily confused by the shouts and screams, my hands reaching automatically for sponge and oxygen, syringe and alcohol, visions of a hospital emergency room vivid around me. Then I drew breath and smelled wood smoke, not ethanol. I shook my head, blinking at the sight of a rumpled blue and yellow quilt, the peaceful row of clothes on their pegs, and the wash of pure, pale light streaming through half-open shutters. Home. I was home, on the ridge. A door banged open below, and the racket died abruptly, succeeded by a scuffle of flight accompanied by muffled giggling.
"Mm-hmm," said Mrs. Bugg's voice, grimly satisfied at having routed the rioters.
The door closed, and the clank of wood and clang of metal from below announced the commencement of the day's activities. When I went down a few moments later, I found that good lady engaged simultaneously in toasting bread, boiling coffee, making porridge, and complaining as she tidied up the men's leavings. Not about the untidiness, what else could be expected of men, but rather that Jamie had not waked her to provide a proper breakfast for them. "And how's himself to manage, then?" she demanded, brandishing the toasting fork at me in reproach. "A fine, big man like that, and him out and doing we no more to line his weem than a wee sup of milk and a steel bannock?" Casting a bleary eye over the assorted crumbs and dirty crockery, it appeared to me that himself and his companions had probably accounted for at least 2 dozen corn muffins and an entire loaf of salt-rising bread, accompanied by a pound or so of fresh butter, a jar of honey, a bowl of raisins, and all of the first milking. "I don't think he'll starve," I murmured, dabbing up a crumb with a moistened forefinger. "Is the coffee ready?" The older Chisholm and MacLeod children had mostly been sleeping by the kitchen hearth at nights, rolled in rags or blankets. They were up and out now, their coverings heaped behind the settle. As the smell of food began to permeate the house, murmurous sounds of rising began to come through the walls and down the stairs as the women dressed and tended the babies and toddlers. Small faces began to reappear from outside, peeking hungrily round the edge of the door. "Have you washed your filthy paws, wee heathens?" Mrs. Bug demanded, seeing them. She waved a porridge spoon at the benches along the table. "If you have, come in and set yourselves doon. Mind you wipe your muddy feet." Within moments, the benches and stools were filled. Mrs. Chisholm, Mrs. MacLeod, and Mrs. Aberfeldy, yawning and blinking among their offspring, nodding and murmuring, "Good morning," to me and each other, straightening a kerchief here and a shirt tail there, using a thumb wet with spittle to plaster down the spiked hair on a little boy's head, or wipe a smudge from a little girl's cheek. Faced with a dozen gaping mouths to feed, Mrs. Bug was in her element, hopping back and forth between hearth and table. Watching her bustle to and fro, I thought she must have been a chickadee in a former life. "Did you see Jamie when he left?" I asked. She paused momentarily to refill all the coffee cups, a large uncooked sausage in her other hand. "No, indeed." She shook her head, neat white in its kerch. "I didn't ken a thing about it. I heard my old lad up and stirring before dawn, but I thought it was only him out to the privy, he not liking to trouble me with the noise of the pot. He didn't come back, though, and by the time I waked myself, they'd all gone off. Ah! None of that now." Catching a movement from the corner of her eye, she dotted a 6-year-old MacLeod smartly on the head with her sausage, causing him to snatch his fingers back from the jam jar.
"Perhaps they've gone hunting," Mrs. Aberfeldy suggested timidly, spooning porridge into the little girl she held on her knee. Barely 19, she seldom said much, shy of the older women.
"Better they be hunting homesteads and timber for houses," Mrs. MacLeod said, hoisting a baby onto her shoulder and patting its back.
She pushed a strand of greying hair out of her face and gave me a wry smile.
"It's nae reflection upon your hospitality, Mrs. Fraser, but I'd as soon not spend the winter under your feet. Geordie, leave your sister's plats alone, or you'll wish you had."
Not at my best so early in the day, I smiled and murmured something politely incomprehensible. I would as soon not have 5 or 10 extra people in my house for the winter either, but I wasn't sure it could be avoided. The governor's letter had been quite specific. All able-bodied men in the back country were to be mustered as militia troops and to report to Salisbury by mid-December. That left very little time for house-building. Still, I hoped Jamie had some plan for relieving the congestion. Adzo the kitten had taken up semi-permanent residence in a cupboard in my surgery, and the scene in the kitchen was quickly assuming its usual daily resemblance to one of the paintings of Hieronymus Bosch. At least the kitchen had lost its early morning chill with so many bodies crowded into it, and was now comfortably warm and noisy. What with the mob scene, though, it was several moments before I noticed that there were 4 young mothers present, rather than 3. "Where did you come from?" I asked, startled at sight of my daughter huddled frowsily under a rug in a corner of the settle. Bree blinked sleepily and shifted Jemmy, who was nursing with single-minded concentration, oblivious of the crowd. "The mulers showed up in the middle of the night and pounded on our door," she said, yawning. 8 of them. They didn't speak much English, but I think they said Da sent for them." "Really?" I reached for a slice of raisin cake, narrowly beating a young Chisholm to it. "Are they still there?"
Ah, thanks, Mama.
She stretched out a hand for the bit of cake I offered her.
Yes, Da came and hauled Roger out of bed while it was still dark, but he didn't seem to think he needed the Mueller's yet. When Roger left, a big old Mueller got up off the floor, said, "Bitte, Meidel," and lay down next to me.
A delicate pink flushed her cheeks, so I thought maybe I'd get up and come up here.
Oh,
I said, suppressing a smile, that would be Gerhard. Eminently practical, the old farmer would see no reason why he should lay his old bones on a hard plank floor if there was bed space available.
I suppose so, she said indistinctly through a mouthful of cake. I guess he's harmless, but even so...
Well, he'd be no danger to you, I agreed. Gerhard Mueller was the patriarch of a large German family who lived between the Ridge and the Moravian settlement at Salem. He was somewhere in his late 70s, but by no means harmless. I chewed slowly, remembering how Jamie had described to me the scalps nailed to the door of Gerhard's barn. Women's scalps, long hair dark and silken, ends lifting in the wind.
Like live things, he'd said, his face troubled at the memory, like birds pinned to the wood.
And the white one Gerhard had brought to me, wrapped in linen and flecked with blood.
No, not harmless.
I swallowed, the cake feeling dry in my throat.
Harmless or not, they'll be hungry, said Mrs. Chisholm practically.
She bent and gathered up a corn dolly, a soggy diaper, and a squirming toddler, contriving somehow to leave a hand free for her coffee.
Best we clear this lot a while before the Germans smell food and come hammering at the door. Is there anything left to feed them?
I said, uneasily trying to remember how many hams were left in the smoke shed. After 2 weeks of hospitality, our stores were dwindling at an alarming rate.
Of course there is, Mrs. Bug said briskly, slicing sausage and flipping the slices onto the sizzling griddle. Let me just have done with this lot, and you can send them along for their breakfasts. You, avon ye.
She tapped a girl of 8 or so on the head with her spatula.
Run ye doon the fruit cellar and fetch me up an apron full of potatoes. Germans like potatoes.
By the time I had finished my porridge and begun to collect up bowls to wash, Mrs. Bug, broom in hand, was sweeping children and debris out of the back door with ruthless efficiency, while issuing a stream of orders to Lizzie and Mrs. Aberfeldy. Ruth, that was her name, who seemed to have been dragooned as assistant cooks.
"Shall I help?"
I began rather feebly, but Mrs. Bug shook her head and made small shooing motions with the broom.
"Dinna think of it, Mrs. Freezer," she said. "You'll have enough to do, I'm sure. And here now, you'll no be coming into my nice clean kitchen with those mucky boots. Out, out, and wipe them off before you think of setting foot in here."
Gerhard Mueller, followed by his sons and nephews, stood in the doorway nonplussed. Mrs. Bug, undeterred either by the fact that he towered over her by more than a foot, or that he spoke no English, screwed up her face and poked fiercely at his boots with her broom. I waved to the Muellers, then seized the chance of escape, and fled. Seeking to avoid the crowd in the house, I washed at the well outside, then went to the sheds and occupied myself in taking inventory. The situation wasn't as bad as I'd feared. We had enough, with careful management, to last out the winter, though I could see that Mrs. Bug's lavish hand might have to be constrained a bit. Besides 6 hams in the smoke shed, there were 4 sides of bacon and half another, plus a rack of dried venison and half of a relatively recent carcass. Looking up, I could see the low roof beams, black with soot and thick with clusters of smoked dried fish, split and bound stiffly in bunches, like the petals of large, ugly flowers. There were 10 casks of salt fish as well, and 4 of salt pork. A stone crock of lard, a smaller one of the fine leaf lard, another of head cheese. I had my doubts about that. I had made it according to the instructions of one of the Mueller women, as translated by Jamie, but I'd never seen head cheese myself, and wasn't quite sure it was meant to look like that. I lifted the lid and sniffed cautiously, but it smelled all right, mildly spiced with garlic and peppercorn, and no scent at all of putrefaction. Perhaps we wouldn't die of ptomaine poisoning, though I had it in mind to invite Gerhard Müller to try it first.
"How can you bide the old fiend in your house?" Massali had demanded when Gerhard and one of his sons had ridden up to the ridge a few months earlier.
She had heard the story of the Indian women from Fergus and viewed the Germans with horrified revulsion.
"And what would you have me do?"
Jamie had demanded in return, spoon lifted halfway from his bowl.
"Kill the Müllers, all of them. For if I did for Gerhard, I'd have to do for the lot and nail their hair to my barn."
His mouth quirked slightly.
"I should think it would put the cow off her milk. It would put me off the milking, to be sure."
Masali's brow puckered, but she wasn't one to be joked out of an argument.
"Not that, maybe," she said. "But you let them into your house and treat them as friends."
She glanced from Jamie to me, frowning.
"The women he killed, they were your friends, no?"
I exchanged a look with Jamie and gave a slight shrug. He paused for a moment, gathering his thoughts as he slowly stirred his soup. Then he laid down the spoon and looked at her.
"It was a fearful thing that Gerhard did," he said simply. "But it was a matter of vengeance to him. Thinking as he did, he couldn't have done otherwise. Would it make matters better for me to take vengeance on him?"
"No,"
Fergus said positively. He laid a hand on Masali's arm, putting a stop to whatever she might have said next. He grinned up at her.
"Of course, Frenchmen do not believe in vengeance."
"Well, perhaps some Frenchmen," I murmured, thinking of the Comte Saint-Germain.
Masali wasn't to be put off so easily, though.
"Hm," she said. "What you mean is, they weren't yours, isn't it?"
Seeing Jamie's brow flick up in startlement, she pressed the point.
"The women who were murdered. But if it were your family, if it had been me and Lizzie and Brianna, say..."
"That," said Jamie evenly, "is my point. It was Gerhard's family."
He pushed back from the table and stood up, leaving half his soup unfinished.
"Are you done, Fergus?"
Fergus cocked a sleek brow at him, picked up his bowl and drank it down, Adam's apple bobbing in his long brown throat.
"Oui," he said, wiping his mouth on his sleeve.
He stood and patted Masali on the head, then plucked a strand of her straw-pale hair free of her kerch.
"Do not worry yourself, Sherry. Even though I do not believe in vengeance, if anyone should hunt your hair, I promise I will make a tobacco pouch of his scrotum. And your papa will tie up his stockings with the malefactor's entrails, surely."
Masali gave a small pfft of irritated amusement and slapped at his hand, and no more was said about Gerhard Müller. I lifted the heavy crock of head cheese and set it down by the door of the smoke shed, so as not to forget it when I went back to the house. I wondered whether Gerhard's son Frederick had come with him.
Likely so.
The boy was less than 20, not an age willing to be left out of anything that promised excitement. It was Frederick's young wife Petronella and her baby who had died of measles, though Gerhard had thought the infection a deliberate curse put on his family by the Tuscarora. Had Frederick found a new wife yet? I wondered.
Very likely.
Though if not, there were two teenaged girls among the new tenants. Perhaps Jamie's plans involved finding them fast husbands. And then there was Lizzie. The corn crib was more than three quarters full, though there were worrying quantities of mouse droppings on the ground outside. Adso was growing rapidly, but perhaps not fast enough. He was just about the size of an average rat. Flour, that was a little low. Only 8 sacks. There might be more at the mill, though. I must ask Jamie. Sacks of rice and dried beans, bushels of hickory nuts, butternuts, and black walnuts, heaps of dried squash, burlap bag of oatmeal and cornmeal, and gallon upon gallon of apple cider and cider vinegar. A crock of salted butter, another of fresh,
and a basket of spherical goat cheeses, for which I had traded a bushel of blackberries and another of wild currants. The rest of the berries had been carefully dried, along with the wild grapes, or made up into jam or preserve, and were presently hidden in the pantry, safe, I hoped, from childish depredations. The honey. I stopped, pursing my lips. I had nearly 20 gallons of purified honey, and 4 large stone jars of honeycomb, gleaned from my hives, and waiting to be rendered and made into beeswax candles. It was all kept in the walled cave that served as stable, in order to keep safe from bears. It wasn't safe from the children, who had been deputed to feed the cows and pigs in the stable, though. I hadn't seen any telltale sticky fingers or faces yet, but it might be as well to take some preventative steps. Between meat, grain, and the small dairy, it looked as though no one would starve this winter. My concern now was the lesser but still important threat of vitamin deficiency. I glanced at the chestnut grove, its branches now completely bare. It would be a good 4 months before we saw much of fresh greenery, though I did have plenty of turnips and cabbage still in the ground. The root cellar was reassuringly well stocked, heady with the earthy smell of potatoes, the tang of onions and garlic, and the wholesome, bland scent of turnips. 2 large barrels of apples stood at the back, with the prints of several sets of childish feet leading up to them, I saw. I glanced up. Enormous clusters of wild scuppernong grapes had been hung from the rafters, drying slowly into raisins. They were still there, but the lower, more reachable bunches had been reduced to sprays of bare stems. Perhaps I needn't worry about outbreaks of scurvy, then. I wandered back toward the house, trying to calculate how many provisions should be sent with Jamie and his militia, how much left for the consumption of the wives and children. Impossible to say. That would depend in part on how many men he raised and on what they might bring with them. He was appointed colonel, though. The responsibility of feeding the men of his regiment would be primarily his, with reimbursement, if it ever came, to be paid later by appropriation of the assembly. Not for the first time, I wished heartily that I knew more. How long might the assembly be a functional body? Brianna was out by the well, walking round and round it with a meditative look furrowing her brows. "Pipe," she said, without preliminaries. "Do people make metal piping now? The Romans did, but..." "I've seen it in Paris and Edinburgh, being used to carry rain off roofs," I offered. "So it exists. I'm not sure I've seen any in the colonies, though. If there is any, it will be terribly expensive." Beyond the simplest of things, like horseshoes, all ironmongery had to be imported from Britain, as did all other metal goods like copper, brass, and lead. At least they'll know what it is. She narrowed her eyes, calculating the slope of land between well and house, then shook her head and sighed. I can make a pump, I think. Getting water into the house is something else. She yawned suddenly and blinked, eyes watering slightly in the sunlight. God, I'm so tired. I can't think. Jemmy squawked all night, and just when he finally conked out, the Mullahs showed up. I don't think I slept at all. I recall the feeling, I said with sympathy, and grinned. Was I a very cranky baby? Brianna asked, grinning back. Very, I assured her, turning toward the house. And where's yours? He's with... Brianna stopped dead, clutching my arm. What? She said. What in the name of God is that? I turned to look and felt a spasm of shock deep in the pit of my stomach. It's quite evident what it is, I said, walking slowly toward it. The question is, why? It was a cross, rather a big cross, made of dried pine boughs stripped of their twigs and bound together with rope. It was planted firmly at the edge of the dooryard, near the big blue spruce that guarded the house. It stood some 7 feet in height, the branches slender but solid. It wasn't bulky or obtrusive, and yet its quiet presence seemed to dominate the dooryard,
much as a tabernacle dominates a church. At the same time, the effect of the thing seemed neither reverent nor protective. In fact, it was bloody sinister.
"Are we having a revival meeting?"
Brianna's mouth twitched, trying to make a joke of it. The cross made her as uneasy as it did me.
"Not that I've heard of."
I walked slowly round it, looking up and down. Jamie had made it. I could tell that by the quality of the workmanship. The branches had been chosen for straightness and symmetry, carefully trimmed, the ends tapered. The crosspiece had been neatly notched to fit the upright, the rope binding criss-crossed with a sailor's neatness.
"Maybe Dar's starting his own religion."
Brianna lifted a brow. She recognised the workmanship too. Mrs. Bug appeared suddenly round the corner of the house, a bowl of chicken feed in her hands. She stopped dead at the sight of us, her mouth opening immediately. I braced myself instinctively for the onslaught and heard Brianna snicker under her breath.
"Oh, there you are, ma'am. I was just saying to Lizzie as how it was a shame, a mortal shame it is, that those spawn should be rioting upstairs in Doon and their nasty leavings scattered all about the house, and even in herself's own still room. And she said to me, did Lizzie, she said, in my surgery,
what?
Where?
What have they done?"
Forgetting the cross, I was already hastening toward the house, Mrs. Bug hard on my heels, still talking.
"I did catch two of them wee deals a-playing at bowls in there with their nice blue bottles and an apple. And be sure I boxed their ears say hard for it. I'm sure they're ringing still, the wicked creatures. And them a-leaving bits of good food to rot and go bad, and my bread."
I had reached the front hall and now flung open the door of the surgery to find everything within spick and span, including the countertop where I had laid out my most recent penicillin experiments. It now lay completely bare, its oaken surface scoured to rawness.
"Nasty it was," Mrs. Bug said from the hall behind me.
She pressed her lips together with prim virtue.
"Nasty! Covered we mould, just covered, all blue and..."
I took a deep breath, hands clenched at my sides to avoid throttling her. I shut the surgery door, blotting out the sight of the empty counter, and turned to the tiny Scotswoman.
"Mrs. Buck," I said, keeping my voice level with great effort, "you know how much I appreciate your help, but I did ask you not to."
The front door swung open and crashed into the wall beside me.
"You wretched old bosom! How dare you lay hands on my wains!"
I swung round to find myself nose to nose with Mrs. Chisholm, face flushed with fury and armed with a broom, two red-faced toddlers clinging to her skirts, their cheeks smeared with recent tears. She ignored me completely, her attention focused on Mrs. Bug, who stood in the hallway on my other side, bristling like a diminutive hedgehog.
"You and your precious wains!" Mrs. Bug cried indignantly. "Why, if you cared to stitch for them, you'd be raising them proper and teaching them right from wrong, not leaving them to carouse about the house like Barbary apes, strewing wreck and ruin from attic to doorstep, and laying their sticky fingers on anything as isn't a nail to the floor."
"Now, Mrs. Bug, really, I'm sure they didn't mean..." My attempt at peacemaking was drowned out by steam whistle shrieks from all three Chisholms, Mrs. Chisholm's being by far the loudest.
"Who are you to be calling my bairns thieves, you maundering old nettercap?"
The aggrieved mother waved the broom menacingly, moving from side to side as she tried to get at Mrs. Bug. I moved with her, hopping back and forth in an effort to stay between the two combatants.
"Mrs. Chisholm," I said, raising a placating hand. "Margaret, really, I'm sure that... Who am I?"
Mrs. Bug seemed to expand visibly like rising dough.
"Who am I? Why, I'm a God-fearing woman and a Christian soul. Who are you to be speaking to your elders and betters in such a way? You and your evil tribe are traipsing the hills in rags and tatters. We have so much as a boat to piss in." "Mrs. Buck," I exclaimed, whirling round to her, "you mustn't."
Mrs. Chisholm didn't bother trying to find a rejoinder to this, but instead lunged forward, broom at the ready. I flung my arms out to prevent her shoving past me, Finding herself foiled in her attempt to swat Mrs. Bug, she instead began poking at her over my shoulder, jabbing wildly with the broom as she tried to skewer the older woman. Mrs. Bug, obviously feeling herself safe behind the barricade of my person, was hopping up and down like a ping-pong ball, her small round face bright red with triumph and fury.
"Beggars!" she shouted at the top of her lungs. "Tinkers! Gypsies!"
"Mrs. Chisholm! Mrs. Bug!" I pleaded, but neither paid the least attention.
"Kittock! Miss Lernet Belch!" bellowed Mrs. Chisholm, jabbing madly with her broom.
The children shrieked and yowled, and Mrs. Chisholm, who was a rather buxom woman, trod heavily on my toe. This came under the heading of more than enough, and I rounded on Mrs. Chisholm with fire in my eye. She shrank back, dropping the broom.
"Ha! You pert trull! You and—"
Mrs. Bug's shrill cries behind me were suddenly silenced, and I whirled round again to see Brianna, who had evidently run round the house and come in through the kitchen, holding the diminutive Mrs. Bug well off the floor, one arm round her middle, the other hand pressed firmly across her mouth. Mrs. Bug's tiny feet kicked wildly, her eyes bulging above the muffling hand. Bree rolled her eyes at me and retreated through the kitchen door, carrying her captive. I turned round to deal with Mrs. Chisholm, only to see the flick of her homespun grey skirt disappearing hastily round the corner of the doorstep, a child's wail receding like a distant siren. The broom lay at my feet. I picked it up, went into the surgery, and shut the door behind me. I closed my eyes, hands braced on the empty counter. I felt a sudden irrational urge to hit something, and did. I slammed my fist on the counter, pounded it again and again with the meaty side of my hand, but it was built so solidly that my blows made scarcely any sound, and I stopped, panting. What on earth was the matter with me? Annoying as Mrs. Bug's interference was, it wasn't critical. Neither was Mrs. Chisholm's maternal pugnacity. She and her little fiends would be gone from the house sooner or later. Sooner, I hoped. My heart had begun to slow a little, but prickles of irritation still ran over my skin like nettle rash. I tried to shake it off, opening the big cupboard to assure myself that neither Mrs. Bug's nor the children's depredations had harmed anything truly important. No, it was all right. Each glass bottle had been polished to a jewel-like gleam. The sunlight caught them in a blaze of blue and green and crystal. But each had been put back exactly in its place, each neatly written label turned forward. The gauzy bundles of dried herbs had been shaken free of dust, but carefully hung back on their nails. The sight of the assembled medicines was calming. I touched a jar of anti-louse ointment, feeling a miser's sense of gratification at the number and variety of bags and jars and bottles. Alcohol lamp, alcohol bottle, microscope, large amputation saw, jar of sutures, box of plasters, packet of cobweb, all were arrayed with military precision, drawn up in ranks like ill-assorted recruits under the eye of a drill sergeant. Mrs. Bug might have the flaws of her greatness, but I couldn't help but admit her virtue as a housekeeper. The only thing in the cabinet that plainly hadn't been touched was a tiny leather bag, the amulet given to me by the Tuscaroran shaman, Nyaweni, that lay askew in a corner by itself. Interesting that Mrs. Bug wouldn't touch that, I thought. I'd never told her what it was, though it did look Indian, with the feathers, from raven and woodpecker, thrust through the knot. Less than a year in the colonies, and less than a month in the wilderness, Mrs. Bug regarded all things Indian with acute suspicion. The odour of lye soap hung in the air, reproachful as a housekeeper's ghost. I supposed I couldn't really blame her. Mouldy bread, rotted melon, and mushy apple slices might be research to me, but to Mrs. Bug they could be nothing but a calculated offence to the god of cleanliness. I sighed and closed the cupboard, adding the faint perfume of dried lavender and the skunk scent of pennyroyal to the ghosts of lye and rotted apples. I'd lost experimental preparations many times before, and this one hadn't been either complex or in a greatly advanced state. It would take no more than half an hour to replace it, setting out fresh bits of bread and other samples. I wouldn't do it, though. There wasn't enough time. Jamie was clearly beginning to gather his militiamen. It could be no more than a few days before they would depart for Salisbury to report to Governor Tryon. Before we would depart, for I certainly meant to accompany them. It occurred to me, quite suddenly, that there hadn't been enough time to finish the experiment when I'd set it up to begin with. I had known we would leave soon. Even if I got immediate good growth, I couldn't have had time to collect, dry, purify. I'd known that consciously. And yet I had done it anyway, gone right on with my plans, pursuing my routines as though life were still settled and predictable, as though nothing whatever might threaten the tenor of my days, as though acting might make it true. "You really are a fool, Beecham," I murmured, pushing a curl of hair tiredly behind one ear. I went out, shutting the door of the surgery firmly behind me, and went to negotiate peace between Mrs. Bugg and Mrs. Chisholm. Superficially, peace in the house was restored, but an atmosphere of uneasiness remained. The women went about their work tense and tight-lipped. Even Lizzie, the soul of patience, was heard to say, "Oh," when one of the children spilled a pan of buttermilk across the steps. Even outside, the air seemed to crackle, as though a lightning storm were near. As I went to and fro, from sheds to house, I kept glancing over my shoulder at the sky above Rhone Mountain, half expecting to see the loom of thunderheads. And yet, the sky was still the pale slate blue of late autumn, clouded with nothing more than the wisps of mares' tails. I found myself distracted, unable to settle to anything. I drifted from one task to another, leaving a pile of onions half-braided in the pantry, a bowl of beans half-shelled on the stoop, a pair of torn breeks lying on the settle, needle dangling from its thread. Again and again I found myself crossing the yard, coming from nowhere in particular, bound upon no specific errand. I glanced up each time I passed the cross, as though expecting it either to have disappeared since my last trip, or to have acquired some explanatory notice neatly pinned to the wood. If not, Jesus Nazarenus, Rex Judaeorum, then something. The cross remained, two simple sticks of pine wood bound together by a rope. Nothing more. Except, of course, that a cross is always something more. I just didn't know what it might be this time. Everyone else seemed to share my distraction. Mrs. Bugg, disedified by the conflict with Mrs. Chisholm, declined to make any lunch and retired to her room, ostensibly suffering from headache, though she refused to let me treat it. Lizzie, normally a fine hand with food, burned the stew, and billows of black smoke stained the oak beams above the hearth. At least the Mullers were safely out of the way. They had brought a large cask of beer with them, and had retired after breakfast back to Brianna's cabin, where they appeared to be entertaining themselves very nicely. The bread refused to rise. Jemmy had begun a new tooth, a hard one, and screamed and screamed and screamed. The incessant screeching twisted everyone's nerves to the snapping point, including mine. I should have liked to suggest that Bree take him away somewhere out of earshot, but I saw the deep smudges of fatigue under her eyes and the strain on her face, and hadn't the heart. Mrs. Chisholm, tried by the constant battles of her own offspring, had no such compunction.
"For God's sake, why do you no tuck that bird away to your own cabin, lass?" she snapped. "If he man greets you, there's no need for us all to hear it."
Bree's eyes narrowed dangerously.
"Because," she hissed, "your two oldest sons are sitting in my cabin drinking with the Germans. I wouldn't want to disturb them."
Mrs. Chisholm's face went bright red. Before she could speak, I quickly stepped forward and snatched the baby away from Bree.
"I'll take him out for a bit of a walk, shall I?"
I said, hoisting him onto my shoulder. "I could use some fresh air." "Why don't you go up and lie down on my bed for a bit, darling?" I said to Bree. "You look just a little tired."
"Uh-huh,"
she said. One corner of her mouth twitched. And the Pope's a little bit Catholic, too. Thanks, Mama.
She kissed Jemmy's hot, wet cheek and vanished toward the stairwell.
Mrs. Chisholm scowled horridly after her, but caught my eye, coughed, and called to her 3-year-old.